KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, a jury has declared Jose Inez Garcia Zarate not guilty of all murder and manslaughter charges in the San Francisco killing of Catherine Steinle. We examine Zarate's acquittal and its implications for the national debate on immigration and sanctuary cities. Then at 9:30, according to the book of Genesis, God created man in his image. But according to author Reza Aslan, it is we who have humanized God with all of our good and bad qualities. This, Aslan says, has consequences. He joins us in the studio to discuss his latest book, God, A Human History. Join us. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. A jury last night found Jose Inez Garcia Zarate not guilty of murdering Catherine Steinle in a case that drew national attention to San Francisco's sanctuary city policy. Garcia Zarate had been deported 5 times and was wanted for a 6th deportation when Steinle was killed. Garcia Zarate's attorneys argued that he'd accidentally killed Steinle on San Francisco's Embarcadero in 2015 and that he picked up an object that he didn't know was a gun and it fired. President Trump called the verdict disgraceful, and the Justice Department is considering bringing federal charges against Garcia Zarate, according to the White House. We look at the implications of the verdict and take your questions in this opening half-hour forum. And that number to call to weigh in is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also share your responses and questions on Facebook. You can tweet us at KQED Forum. You can email us at forum@kqed.org. Joining us for the half hour is Laura Bazelon. She's a law professor at USF School of Law. Good morning, Laura Bazelon.
Good morning.
And also with us is Jim Hammer. He's former San Francisco prosecutor and former SF police commissioner. Good morning, Jim Hammer.
Good to be with you.
Thanks for being here. And Alex Emsley joins us, who's been covering the trial since it started. He's a reporter for KQED News. And of course, Alex, you were there last night. Just start by telling us what it was like at the courthouse.
Yeah, I mean, the crowd outside the courtroom waiting to get in has kind of fluctuated, right? There was a big crowd at opening statements, then as you might expect, it kind of dwindles. For the verdict, I mean, the entire hall outside of the courtroom, it's a very large hall with access to several courtrooms, was filled with people, either press, ready to file into the courtroom, and public who had participated in a public seating lottery to try to get a seat. I was surprised. A lot of attorneys were watching this case because it has some, I think, really interesting kind of legal aspects to it that don't always come up in murder trials. So there was a lot of observers without a dog in the fight necessarily.
And Laura Bazelon, remind us what the options were before the jury in terms of what verdict they could render.
The prosecution was seeking a verdict on first-degree murder, and that was the thrust of the prosecutor's argument in closing. They also had the additional option of convicting on lesser-included offenses. So those would be second-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter.
And we should remind listeners that he, Garcia Zarate, was only convicted of possession of a firearm. What did the jury need to believe to reach that particular conclusion, Laura Bazelon?
That conclusion was almost conceded, basically that he had a felony conviction and there really wasn't any dispute about that, and that at some point he was in possession of the gun, which he admitted. And so I think that that verdict was a foregone conclusion. The conclusion that he was guilty of first-degree murder or second-degree murder or involuntary manslaughter required a much greater burden of proof on behalf of the prosecution.
But do you think that the jury believed the defense's argument that this was an accidental killing?
I do.
And to do that, I mean, really what was before them in terms of rendering that verdict was what? What was the burden on the prosecution?
The burden on the prosecution was to show for first-degree murder that Mr. Zarate intentionally and with premeditation killed this woman, to prove that it was involuntary manslaughter. They had to show essentially that it was a criminally negligent homicide, which still requires a level of intent, but it's a level that's closer to the negligent standard. And the jury had to be convinced that essentially this man on some level intended to kill this woman, and they were not convinced of that.
Where did the prosecution go wrong, Jim Hammer?
Well, listen, good prosecutors try tough cases, so, and sometimes you get a bad result. From the media reports, and I wasn't in the courtroom every day, it seems that to argue first-degree murder was a stretch too far. And the danger, as any trial lawyer, I was briefly a defense attorney but mostly been a prosecutor, if you lose connection with that jury, meaning, you know, you're not seeing where they are and you're arguing a reasonable argument in their mind, you can lose them entirely. They just tune you out and they listen to another source, maybe the judge, maybe the defense attorney. So the question is, the open question, and I don't know the answer, is if they had not argued premeditated first-degree murder and simply had gone for implied malice murder, which doesn't require intent but does require gross recklessness, conscious disregard for human life, and basically stuck to non-intentional killing, you know, might they have persuaded the jury? I don't know the answer. Nobody does.
Alex Emsley.
Well, one of the major points that the prosecution tried to make on two separate occasions was that the gun involved in this killing, that Garcia Zarate could have brought it with him to the pier. The defense was arguing that he found it moments before the shooting, basically stashed underneath a chair that he was sitting in. Twice, there was a demonstration in court where one time the lead homicide inspector in the case and one time the prosecutor herself showed that this gun could have fit into pockets that in clothing that Garcia Zarate was wearing at the time that he was arrested at the time of the shooting. It seemed like a stretch of an inference. It wasn't enough to just say, look, this object fits in a pocket, so that must be the case.
Jim Hammer.
Yeah, I think the most important legal concept people should be aware of, and Alex backed into it, is in a circumstantial evidence case, which this is, meaning he didn't say, I'm going to kill you and, you know, pull the trigger. The jury is instructed by the judge that if there are two reasonable explanations, so it could have been hidden in the pocket or he could have found it that day, if they find both are reasonable, they are commanded by the instruction to find the inference which points to innocence. So even if the DA had a pretty good argument, but the jury said this is another reasonable possibility, they had to find for the defendant, meaning it was an accident.
Which is why there have been a lot of legal experts who have been saying that they were not surprised by this verdict in the sense that that there was not evidence beyond reasonable doubt, right, which is what the prosecution had to prove. But, you know, overall, this has been painted as a stunning verdict, a shocking verdict. I think a lot of people were expecting, if at the very least, an involuntary manslaughter charge. So, Laura Bazelon, were you surprised by this verdict?
Not at all. And I think people who followed the case closely and people who understand the evidence that was actually presented to the jury versus the narrative that was spun by Donald Trump during the campaign were not surprised by this verdict. Because the public was told during the presidential election that this was about a terribly violent person who came back to this country over and over again, and it was about the failure of San Francisco to adequately crack down on illegal immigration. And what the jury was told was that this was someone who was not violent, who, yes, had been deported numerous times, but had no history of violence. And they were to put really the immigration and the sanctuary city piece of it out of their minds and focus simply on whether the prosecution, as Jim alluded to, met their burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It seems to me like a case that's really a vindication of the jury system in that the jurors, they followed the instructions. They weren't swept away by the passions that have been incited by this case nationally and about just the horrible way that this beautiful young woman died. They were focused on whether this was an intentional killing or whether this was some kind of reckless and wanton killing. And in the end, they agreed with the defense that it was an accident. And I did want to just say, following up on Jim's point about the circumstantial evidence instruction, which I agree was the key instruction in this case, the jurors had real questions about that gun. The gun was the centerpiece in a way of the defense case. And what the defense was arguing was that this was a gun that could have accidentally fired. And what the prosecution was saying was, no, it really couldn't. There had to be an intent behind pulling the trigger.
Pull of the trigger.
And the defense had argued, let the jurors look at this gun, let the jurors handle this gun so they can see for themselves what it would be like to pull the trigger. And the judge refused. And during the deliberations, the jurors asked if they could handle the gun, and they were told no. And I think that was actually a critical part of this case, because what it left open to the jurors was doubt. They had doubt about whether it was easy or hard to pull that trigger. And as Jim says, doubt has to be resolved in favor of the defendant.
Yeah, well, let's hear what our listeners think and also what they think of the implications of this verdict. Let's start with Andre in Toledo, Ohio. Good morning, Andre.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
I just wanted to say that I thought it was interesting that President Trump himself said that he could shoot a man on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. And then he used this case in California to rally his xenophobic and largely racist base of supporters. And then the jury ended up acquitting him. So if anything, I guess I agree with your commentators that this really is like a vindication of the legal system and especially the jury system.
Well, Andre, thanks. Thank you for that comment. Alex Emsa, you've just done a piece about the political implications of this verdict. How do you think it will be used to further one political agenda or another?
Well, it's already being used, and I should say that our colleague Scott Schaefer had a lot to do with the political implications around this piece, this case, I should say. But, you know, it's already started. We're seeing we saw reaction almost immediately, I would say, from U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions yesterday, followed pretty quickly by the head of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and then the president himself via his medium of choice, Twitter. These statements, let me put the president aside for a second and just talk about Jeff Sessions and ICE. I mean, they're saying the same thing, and they present it in a way, this is about respect for the rule of law. A crackdown on so-called sanctuary cities is about respecting federal law and federal immigration enforcement. But they use that argument to then criticize what is really a process that's all about the rule of law, a criminal trial where a jury comes to a verdict.
Well, let's go next to Peter in San Carlos. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great.
I think this case really played into, among other things, the ignorance of people in San Francisco about how guns work. I mean, I have put thousands of rounds downrange, and I assure you that a gun like this will only go off if you pull the trigger. Now, we've heard about intent, but we've also heard about negligence and, you know, whether or not the defendant intended to do any harm. Picking up a gun, if you don't know how to operate it, is negligent. And picking one up and putting your finger on the trigger, if you do know how to operate it and having it go off, is also negligence. And that just seems to me like very straightforward manslaughter. I don't see how any other way to spin it. In fact, in your own reporting on the case, you kept on mentioning that the officer had since been promoted, and there was a sort of an implication that perhaps he was negligent. It's a kind of a perverse universe in which the officer is somehow negligent, but the defendant is not. And it's also a perverse universe in which we behave like these guns are somehow magical, mystical objects that go off by themselves. They don't. You have to pull the trigger.
Peter, thank you for that point. And I want to also say, if you want to join this conversation, again, this is a half-hour segment, so the time to call, email, post comments on our website or on Twitter is now. That email address is forum@kqed.org. That website is kqed.org/forum. And the number is 866-733-6786. Jim Hammer, guns don't go off by themselves.
People kill people, right? Not guns. We got to keep something in mind, which is the jury did not declare him innocent. Judges do that sometimes. They declare factual innocence because there's no evidence to support it. All they said was there are multiple interpretations of the evidence that are reasonable, and we have to pick the one pointing defense. So all they said is we have a reasonable doubt. They did not say he's innocent. And the last thing I'd say is I think the system worked. If people don't like the verdict, that's fine. But they ought to respect that 12 strangers went in a room. They never met before. 12 San Franciscans can't agree on who makes the best coffee in San Francisco. For 12 people to go, strangers in a room, and spend 6 days wrestling with the evidence, we should have faith that they did it conscientiously, and we should respect it. But again, they didn't say he's innocent. They said there were reasonable doubts.
Are you saying that you are not surprised by this verdict?
Oh, I was, and I think most people are. Every lawyer and reporter I talked to during the trial were guessing it would be a manslaughter, and that would have been my guess. And I think it's because, remember back 2 years when we first heard about the story, what was the image? Undocumented guy at the pier shoots this girl. That's kind of all you heard. And everyone said, well, he murdered her, right? As you get into the evidence that Alex and others reported, you know, there are key pieces of evidence. The fact that there's one speck of gunshot residue in his hand, people would say, you know, that's consistent with being wrapped up. The ricochet shot, experts have said, if I tried, I couldn't shoot her that way. So, again, I would respect the jury and encourage other people to do the same thing.
We go to more calls. Colin in San Francisco. Hi, Colin.
Good morning. While I'm not surprised but disappointed by the jury's verdict, this all could have been avoided had San Francisco's jail and the sheriff honored ICE's request for a hold. Very briefly, I mean, my feeling is that Congress really does need to step up to the plate here and mandate that local jurisdictions like San Francisco have to honor ICE's request for holds on undocumented felons such as Mr. Zarate or lose federal funding. What is your guest perspective on this?
Thank you, Colin. And Alex Emsley, talk a little bit about how the sanctuary city law was tweaked post Catherine Steinle's killing, and also what you think could happen related to sanctuary city policy moving forward after this.
Sure. I mean, there were some changes to San Francisco's sanctuary city policy. I don't know about the letter of the law necessarily, but on implementation post Catherine Steinle's killing. But to my understanding, those changes would not have affected a person identical to Jose Ynez Garcia Zarate in the situation that he was in when he was released in San Francisco. To the caller's other point, that, you know, maybe there is a place for federal legislation to empower the federal government to, I guess, compel local law enforcement agencies to do what is a federal job in federal jurisdiction. I'm not aware of a precedent for that. I think that would be a very hard road to climb. And frankly, there is a mechanism that the federal government could use if they want to force sanctuary cities to hand people over. It's a warrant, it's a court order, and that's what San Francisco has always maintained.
Well, let's hear next from Wolf in Oakland. Hi, Wolf.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. So the point I'd like to make is that if you were in this courtroom during the entire trial, listening to the evidence like the 12 jurors were, then you don't have any business commenting on the verdict. And for people like Trump to make the comments he does, I think is irresponsible and disrespectful to the 12 people who sat through the entire trial, listened to the evidence, and were not convinced by the prosecution's case.
And what would you say to the family of Catherine Steinle, who felt like justice was rendered but not served?
Well, I mean, I understand how they feel about that, and they certainly have an emotional connection that would lead them that way. But our system of justice is that we try cases to the jury, and there are 12 men and women who are sitting there listening to all the evidence, and they have to be convinced. And the prosecution didn't convince them. Now, maybe they brought the wrong charges. Maybe, as I think one of your commentators said, if that was something that didn't involve intent, they might have had a better shot
at it.
It was
too far. Well, thank you, Wolf. I appreciate hearing that perspective. Laura Bazelon, could I put that question to you? About how the family should be feeling? My heart goes out to the family. I just can't imagine, especially as a parent, a more awful event than walking on a pier with your daughter on a sunny day and having her die in your arms. And I can only imagine that the family is experiencing unbelievable, wrenching heartache and lifelong sorrow over what happened to their daughter. At the same time, the law isn't driven by emotion. And the way that Donald Trump, throughout the case, during the campaign, and now on Twitter, has turned this into sort of a story about borders and yes, murderers, it's really a question of law, and it seems very cold to say that. But what jurors have to do, those six men and six women, what they had to do was weigh the facts that were presented to them against the legal elements. And as the caller said, they just felt that the legal elements weren't met.
Yes. Well, speaking of President Trump, here's, for example, a tweet that he sent 6 hours ago. The Kate Steinle killer came back and back over the weekly protected Obama border, always committing crimes and being violent. And yet this info was not used in court. His exoneration is a complete travesty of justice. Build the wall. So we get a sense of how this will be used as ammunition for his attack on undocumented immigrants and his desire to build a border wall. But at the same time, you know, you had Kate Steinle's brother saying, "I'm stunned that they couldn't even get him, Garcia Zarate, on using the weapon." So can you respond to Ernst's question, which is, can your law professor explain the tests for involuntary manslaughter and why this case did not meet those tests?
Well, I think it kind of goes back to Jim's point about what the jury was asked to convict on by the prosecutor. And so they were really pushed toward a first-degree murder theory. They weren't asked to convict on involuntary manslaughter, and there was no coherent involuntary manslaughter theory that was presented to them by the prosecutor. So to convict on that charge, and I agree with Jim that there probably was evidence to support it, they would have had to make their own factual case and come to their own conclusion. So they would have had to decide on their own without benefit of argument by the prosecutor marshaling facts toward supporting that theory. And I think when that happens and you leave it to the jury to marshal the argument for the lesser included offense, that's a bridge too far.
Jim Hammer.
Again, this isn't obvious to people, is it, the law about circumstantial evidence and what manslaughter is. In light of that, and again, this is all, I don't want a Friday morning quarterback, but it's an open question if they had focused not on intentional killing, but all in this realm of negligence. Negligence goes everywhere from simple negligence to criminal negligence to gross recklessness, you know? It's a question if they conceded, I can't prove intent, and sticking to this, it's an open question, you know? And the only person who could tell us is the jury. You know, how did they react? And at the end of the day, I want to say one last thing. Most cases come down to evidence, meaning, you know, a brilliant DA doesn't usually win the case or a brilliant defense attorney doesn't usually win the case. It comes down to the evidence at the end of the day. And you can't change the evidence, you know? You can't change the evidence that his confession or statement had a lot of factually wrong stuff, that he came across as kind of uneducated. You can't hide from the fact there was one GSR on his finger. So,
former San Francisco prosecutor Jim Hammer, thank you.
Thank you, Mina.
And let's go to more of your calls and questions. Let's hear now from Ramsey in Oakland. Hi, Ramsey.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. One thing this has really brought up for me that I just don't understand, I haven't heard discussed, is what is the value of a sanctuary city or a sanctuary state? It appears to be, you know, a place where undocumented criminals would naturally congregate, and I just don't understand the value of maintaining a policy like that.
Ramsey, thank you.
To violate federal intentions, and I just don't get it.
Yes, Alex Emsley, quickly, can you talk about the justification that has been used for sanctuary cities?
Yeah, I think it comes down to conflicting priorities between federal immigration enforcement, federal law enforcement, and local police municipalities. Now, I'm aware of, you know, many, many major police departments that are in support of their cities being sanctuary cities because local law enforcement does not want to play the role of immigration agents. They would much rather people, regardless of their immigration status, are feel free, open, willing, and safe to come to the police and report a crime and to work with prosecutors as witnesses and such. And the way that they've decided to do that is to protect them from, or to try to not cooperate with federal immigration enforcement that could lead to those potential witnesses or victims' deportation.
Well, Tom writes, what a disgrace. A dead woman killed in front of her father. The illegal immigrant held the gun. San Francisco is a disgrace. This father should seek his own justice for his daughter. What's next, Alex Emsley, for Garcia Zarate?
Well, he is facing, his sentencing hearing hasn't yet been scheduled. He's facing a couple of year sentence, at least up to 3 years for being a felon in possession of a handgun. He might get time served for that, honestly, but as I understand, immigration officials are poised to take custody and proceed with deportation.
Alex Emsley, reporter for KQED News. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
Thank you also to Laura Bazelon, law professor at USF School of Law.
Thank you so much.
And thanks to our listeners for sharing your reactions and your questions. We have another half hour of Forum. We'll be talking about God. Stay with us. I'm Mina Kim.